Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your solid gold rebound of music news. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. You're listening to Make Me Like You, the second single from Gwen Stefani's new record, This Is What the Truth Feels Like. And Karen Gans is our guest today to talk about it. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Ben.
Karen, we haven't had you as a guest on the podcast since January 2015, when you were talking about Sleater-Kinney. And since that time, you've become my boss. Incredible leapfrogging move.
What will happen between now and my next podcast,
well,
Ben?
What will happen is you're going to do a lot more podcasts with us, I think. I hope. So Karen is here because she wrote quite an amazing story on the front of Arts and Leisure that came out last Sunday that started being about X and then ended up being about Y. Gwen Stefani has a new record, and it's her first new record in a long time. And I imagine that was the original reason that you went out to interview her.
Yes, I was interested in what she had been doing and what she thought making a pop record now would be like as opposed to making it 10 years ago when the last time she had a pop record was. But then I was sort of taken by surprise when she started talking about her personal life and then didn't stop for 90 minutes.
So you really didn't see this coming?
I mean, I knew it was a part of the songwriting process for this record. I had read a few interviews. I knew that the song seemed very honest. And I was going to talk to her about truth and seeming real, since this is a big issue in pop. And I think a part of Adele's appeal is that we really believe what she's saying, and it's very emotional and raw.
Right.
So that was what I was planning to talk to her about. And then she...
In like a philosophical way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not knowing how philosophical Gwen was going to be about her pop music. But
right.
I know that she takes a strong hand in songwriting, and she takes that very seriously.
Right.
She had said she was going to make a pop record where she, quote unquote, curated it. And solicited tracks written by other writers, and she did that for a little while, and then she just realized that her heart wasn't in it. So she was kind of dragging her feet about releasing it, and then she had a momentous issue in her personal life, which we discussed at length.
Which, of course, you knew about.
Yes.
And many other people knew about.
I read the internet.
So let's talk about the momentous shift.
Okay.
What happened?
Well, Ben, she had been married to Gavin Rossdale, the singer in the band Bush, for 13 years? 14 mm-hmm. years? While there had been rumors of his infidelity along the way, I guess nothing had been proven or she didn't pay attention to them. And then something came to her attention the day after the Grammys in 2015 that she could not ignore, and it shattered her world. She will not discuss the details of it, partially because she seems to be a pretty decent human and she has children, partially I think also because it's in the courts. Her divorce isn't final.
Yeah.
But what seems to have happened is that her husband was discovered to have been cheating on her with one of their nannies, and that it had gone on for 3 years. And Gwen is really a family gal. She's like talks a lot about her happy childhood. Her parents are still together. They got married when they were in high school. Her family is just very family-oriented. So this destroyed her in a way that's hard to put into words. She just mm-hmm. like completely shut down. Mm-hmm. And she was shut down in her house trying to figure out her next move for a very long time. And then she realized she was going to have to songwrite her way out of this abyss.
Okay, but then Blake Shelton.
So that happened too.
When did that happen?
So in the timeline, she performed at the Grammys. The next day she woke up, discovered this horrible news. Apparently the news had been known to those around her for 10 weeks, but people were protecting her and not telling her because they knew she had to finish filming The Voice and get through her performance.
Right.
So then a couple of months passed where she was sort of processing this and figuring out what she wanted to do when she started the songwriting. And in the summer, she had to return to The Voice where she is a coach. The way she told it to me was she got back to work harboring this giant secret, knew she couldn't talk about it, felt extremely anxious about it. And then she discovered that Blake, who she just referred to as a coworker, had been going through what she said was, quote, the exact same thing at the exact same time.
To you, she referred to him only as a coworker?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
She actually does not say Gavin or Blake almost at all. She said Gavin's name once, and it was in reference to an introduction she had gotten to The Voice from Gavin's, before Irving Azoff was her manager, he was Gavin's manager.
So she's sort of referring to Gavin in the past tense there.
Yes.
As opposed to present tense, the present tense reality. So
this is juicy for a podcast, right?
This is really juicy. Yeah. But also Gwen Stefani is somebody who, as I experience her, is somebody who, you know, I see like once a week in the supermarket on a tabloid. But there's not a whole lot of music. This is the first new record in 10 years. Such a long time for a star of her magnitude.
It was a very long stretch.
Right? And there were no doubt records in between those 10 years.
Just one.
This is just for like timeline heads. No Doubt became famous in 1995.
Yes.
And that was not their first record. It was their third record.
Correct.
And they were the ska band that broke the mold, that, you know, bust out of that box and became enormous. The record was called Tragic Kingdom. And so that was 1995. How many more records were there after that?
So there was Return of Saturn in 2000, Rocksteady in 2001.
Yeah.
And then the No Doubt hiatus. So 2004, she makes her first solo record, Love Angel Music Baby.
Yeah. A huge hit.
Huge hit.
Yeah.
Surprising, because when people said, oh, this girl from the rock band is going to go make a pop record, I think it raised a lot of eyebrows. And then it totally worked. She quickly followed it up with The Sweet Escape in 2006.
Yep.
And then another long break until the No Doubt record Push and Shove in 2012. And then another long break until this album in 2016. So there have been long gaps.
Yeah.
But she also has fashion lines and perfumes and things like that.
Right. Here's the thing. She's
46.
She's 46 now. The last record on her own, she was 36. It shouldn't be the case, but for a female pop star, that is a big difference, right?
It
is. Between 36 and 46. I mean, for a guy, who cares in a way, right? But for a female pop star, it's different, perhaps?
It is. I mean, so much of it is predicated on her appearance.
Yep. But then there's the question of what does a 46-year-old female pop star have to tell us? Like, what is the message going to be? It's not going to be the same message as before. She can't go on being the same persona, perhaps, or it has to be tempered, or I don't know, there has to be something different. What do you think about that?
I think it's true.
Yeah.
I also think like the conditions of her personal life changed so immensely. I mean, she had three kids.
Yeah.
But I think she had one when she started. Well, she had zero when she made the first record. And then by the time she now is on her third solo record, she has three kids. We expect rock bands. We expect people's lyrics to mature and to change as they get older. I think I would expect the same thing from a pop artist as well.
Sure.
But there just aren't that many to point to. She doesn't have a ton of peers. I asked her who she considers her peers, and she's like, it's not even about that. You know, I had to write this record, my personal life, my issues. But, you know, just thinking about it myself, you know, other than Janet Jackson and Madonna, there aren't a lot of pop stars over 45,
mm-hmm.
solo female pop stars making records
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm. At that level.
Yeah.
So she occupies an interesting space. I kept thinking about Madonna listening to this new record.
I think about Madonna all the time.
Okay, yes, right. But specifically, listening to this new record, thinking about the space that Gwen Stefani is occupying, I kept going toward Madonna in my mind. And what I kept thinking about was Gwen Stefani's persona is still so young.
It's kind of effortlessly
giddy,
young.
Impressionable. Yeah, right, effortlessly.
Yeah.
Right.
I've been talking about her with people, and we've all agreed that she's sort of an eternal teenager.
Yeah. Is that real?
I think it is real. I mean, actually, I tried to get this across in the story. Like, Gwen is an extremely real star.
Yeah.
And I keep saying she seems so real, and the seems like it's a pejorative, but I was struck by her sincerity, and I really felt the truth of what she was telling me. Truth really weighs heavily on her.
Yeah.
I think having been lied to in her relationship in particular, the idea of truth is foremost for her.
Yeah.
And she wants to be truthful with her fans, and I think she understands that part of her strong connection to her fans is the truth. She pointed to a journal on her table, and she's like, that's the journal where I was writing all these lyrics. And I spoke with some of her co-songwriters, and they were like, you know, she would literally crack open a journal.
Yeah.
The first song that she released from the album was called Used to Love You. And the main line on it, it's a very long series. I don't know why I cry, but I think it's because I remember for the first time since I hated you that
yeah.
I used to love you.
Yeah.
And one of her songwriters, Julia Michaels, said that that came directly from a journal. She read the entire thing out loud, and then she continued to speak. And Julia was like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is a pretty good line. Let's try to write music to it.
Yeah.
And it was awkward because it was such a long line, but they did.
It's a really good line because it's so contorted in the way it expresses something. And it kind of ennobles diary thoughts, which can be contorted and self-absorbed and whatever. But they're also really strong and real. There's something kind of like muddled about that sentiment that it's sort of startling to hear it in a really well-constructed pop song.
Totally. I didn't want to take us too far away from the Madonna thought, too, because my thought about the last Madonna record, Rebel Heart, was that it started from a place of true artistic maturity. If you listen to Madonna talking about making that record, she thinks a lot about the wisdom of her old age. You know, she doesn't consider herself old. She's not. She's physically probably as fit as a 22-year-old, to be honest. But there was a song called Ghost Town about, like, you know, the world is kind of going to hell and it's an apocalyptic universe, but, like, we'll still have each other. She's thinking a lot about big issues and how the world is not always a great place.
Yeah.
And then the back half of that Madonna record, unfortunately, takes a turn into sort of, like, sex songs, as I've been calling them. They're just, like, salacious, weird, not particularly sexy, just sort of like sexy to prove that she can still be sexy songs that seem very immature. So I think ultimately that album is kind of like schizophrenic. You don't know where it lands on the Madonna maturity spectrum. But this Gwen album, even though it has like a mature sense to it, she talks a lot about the breakup. It also has this second part that's all about sort of like the giddiness of her discovering new love with Blake.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel immature. It feels just sort of, as I was saying, it just feels real. It feels honest to Gwen.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes her messaging is kind of interesting because, well, there's a song on it called Naughty. You think that it's going to be, there's going to be some sort of sexual teasing going on in it, you know? But actually, it's like a highly moralizing song.
Yeah, it's a
song
finger wagger.
Yeah, it's a song about finger wagging. But it turns that into like a playful, colorful joke. I mean, everything she does is sort of playful and colorful.
Yes.
You know?
I think like she's an artist where her visual aesthetic and her audio aesthetic are actually very aligned.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah, you sort of picture this sort of bright pop Japanese art, you know, the
right.
stuff that she's into, the pops of colors, the swirls, the,
yeah.
the outfits. You can actually see it. And she's,
right.
she thinks that way. When she started to make the first record, Love Angel, Music Baby, she's like, I knew exactly what it was going to look like.
So, yes. Yeah, so that aesthetic, that just, it feels authentic to her. It doesn't feel like she's trying it on or that she's, you know, using it. You
mm-hmm.
know, she is it.
I think she knows for her talents and her art that artifice and putting things on that aren't authentic for her don't work. Like, I think she has a very true artistic compass about what works and what doesn't for
right,
her.
Right. Okay. So when she was approaching the songwriting of this record, when she really had the idea of this is going to be a personal record, people working with her, people around her were sort of nervous about that, right?
They became nervous.
Yeah.
She started working on her own. Just, you know, I'm going to get in the studio. I'm going to start doing some songwriting. I need to get myself out of this funk. And after she had written a couple of songs that she felt were very true to her, she did bring them to the label. And they called her up and they said, you know, we got to be honest with you. We love you, Gwen, but, like, this might not be relatable. They might be too personal. And we're okay with that. If you're okay making an artistic record and it's not that commercial, we'll let you do that. But the way she interpreted that was just like, but it's over. You know, you're not a star anymore.
Can you decode that for me? Because I don't really understand why the reaction to her bringing personal songs that would probably be relatable because they're authentic, because they're real.
Yeah.
Why would that create concern? Is it because Gwen Stefani is not the right person to be writing songs like that?
I don't know. I mean, my assumption is that it was just all bummer songs. She had not yet come out at the other end of it where she added, you know, more happy songs. And
okay.
I think that
yeah.
at that point in her songwriting cycle, they were listening to it and thinking like, wow, this is a drag.
Oh, okay. Right. So it's not only that it's personal. It was that it was largely a bummer.
Yes. That's what I interpreted that as.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where does Red Flag fit?
Red Flag is a very swaggy, angry song. And she said that she wrote that song first. that she walked into the studio and she was ready to go and just sort of spat it out. One of the songwriters said that she likes to say the word boy when she writes a lot.
Yeah.
I think in that song it's like, oh boy, look at you. You know, you think you're such hot stuff. That was when she was in her furious stage. Mm-hmm. I think that was like right when she was like, you know, she had not yet gotten divorced, but she was trying to decide what she was going to do with Gavin.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Red Flag.
Okay.
Love away, spend the check before it even hits the bank. This is what happens when you don't hear what your mother say. The signs, the signs, the signs, the signs. If you're doing it, using it, no excuse. How you're doing it ruins it, now you lose. This is what happens when you live in with no consequence. The signs, the signs, the signs, the signs. Big mistake, red flags cry.
That was Red Flag from Gwen Stefani's new record, This Is What The Truth Feels Like. Karen, tell us a little bit more about the mechanics of the record, how it was constructed. I mean, we're talking about her ability to turn around this project from a notebook full of bummed out lyrics, you know, into a really self-assured record. But how was that done? Who was she working with?
I would point out it was actually done really quickly, she said, which is interesting. I think it was just a couple of months. I mean, she had spent a long time on that record that I mentioned that she was, quote unquote, curating, that she ended up scrapping.
Yeah.
But from the time she stepped into the studio to make this, I think it was only like 3 or 4 months and it was almost done.
I was really struck by that word that she was curating.
Yeah, she used that word.
What exactly does that mean? I mean, how is that different from how anybody makes records these days? Curating means what?
Well, I think in pop these days, there's this new economy where there's songwriters, and a lot of them live out in L.A., and they write songs, and they shop them from artist to artist to artist to artist. And Gwen, actually, this was one of her first interactions with this. She said that, you know, because she was in a rock band, she didn't even know this, but that she had been offered a song. She passed on it, and it ended up with Maroon 5. And then Maroon 5 called her and said, hey, do you want to guest on this song? And she was like, ha, 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 I'd been offered that song. You know, she had no idea that this is the way it works. Mm-hmm. So I guess in the curation sense, you know, she wouldn't really have a hand in the songwriting. But she does like to be in the studio with songwriters.
But does curating mean she approaches songwriters and asks them to come up with something original according to a concept that she gives
I think
them,
it's or? Even looser than that. I think her A&R approaches a bunch of songwriters and says, hey, I'm working on a Gwen record. What do you have that might be appropriate? And people look in their files and they say, well, this kind of has a little bit of a reggae tinge to it, or this, you know, is sassy.
Oh.
Or, you know, this is a assured woman song, and they pass it along.
I see. It's the other way from how she made this record, which is largely working with the same songwriting team.
Exactly. It's actually the exact opposite.
Okay. So tell us about the songwriting.
Well, she ended up getting paired up in the studio with Justin Tranter and Julia Michaels, who are a pair of songwriters that we actually profiled several weeks ago in Arts and Leisure, mm-hmm. who have a real good cop, bad cop, yin-yang. They're just two entirely different people, and they just bring out different things in artists. And Justin used to be in a band called Semi-Precious Weapons, and he was extremely inspired by Gwen. He said Gwen was one of the main reasons he ever actually started to be in music. So he had some hits, so he got in the studio with her, and he just has sort of like a psychologist's ability to sort of draw it out of you. So she felt very comfortable with him. And they just started writing, and then Julia joined them later. She's a lot younger. She's 22. Gwen at one point said, you know, she's young enough to be my child. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy. But her songwriting talents are very strong, and Gwen recognized that. And they ended up writing almost every track, I think every track on this album together, which is kind of rare in pop now. You'll see a lot of different names when you look at the credits.
Sure.
If you look at Wikipedia. And you will see Justin and Julia on all these tracks. So, yes, so she would come into the studio and with her notes and her scraps of papers and her journals. And Julia said that she came in, you know, she looks like Gwen. It's not like she's wearing her PJs, you know. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have any, like, relaxed studio wear, mm-hmm. you know, makeup, red lipstick, jewelry. But that she said that when she would get in the booth to sing, she'd take all the jewelry off. And then Justin would sort of play with it,
uh-huh.
which is sort of interesting.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, they were writing one and sometimes two songs a day. That's really unheard of.
Yeah.
Very speedy.
Do you think there's a unity in production as well as in songwriting?
I do. I think the album does sound like a cohesive pop album. It's not all over the place.
That's what I thought, too, when I listened to it.
I think it touches on different aspects of the Gwen thing. So you've got your sort of rappy, speak song, saucy songs, like you had mentioned, Naughty and Red Flag. And then you have your ballads and you have your sort of just, you know, regular pop songs, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of variety, but it does sound cohesive. I was actually, what you mentioned before about the song Naughty, where you'd think it would be sort of a salacious song.
Yeah.
And it's not. I think she plays with that a bit on the album, because the opening track is called Misery. And you know it's a breakup album. You're thinking, oh, God.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's about, I found new love who's going to pull me out of my misery. I'm
right.
actually quite happy.
Right. And there's also the fact that there are very few guests on this record.
That's also true.
It's not like every record these days. It's not like every pop record has tons of guests. But in a situation like this, when somebody is coming back from a long absence, mm-hmm. I just feel like I've come to expect them. They're sort of like barnacles
yeah.
on the thing, you know? Is there only one?
There is only one, and it's Fetty Wap, which is... It's an interesting pairing, but she was obsessed with getting him on the album. She imagined him on this song. She wrote the song for him. And then she told me a very long, involved story about how he agreed to do it and then kind of vanished. Mm-hmm. And they were up against the deadline where they had to turn in the album, and she was losing it. And her manager was calling his manager, and she was, like, doing anything to get in touch with him. She tried Irving Azoff. I mean, she was just like, anybody, please. And then out of nowhere, he just sort of sent them the track.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she listened to it, and she was like, I have no idea what he's saying, but I love it. And that is the only guest on the whole album.
Mm. I want to ask the question of, you know, what's it like to talk to Gwen Stefani a little bit more intelligently
sure.
than that question is usually asked? What's it like to talk to Gwen Stefani? I mean, what are her preoccupations? What's her vibe? Like, what kinds of things does she, in the normal run of her conversation, what kinds of things does she bring up?
She was very easy to talk to. She was extremely friendly and open. She uses some words and phrases over and over again, which is, you don't notice that until you're transcribing a 12,000
yeah, sure,
words
sure.
of Gwen.
What are they?
She uses literally very liberally.
Okay.
And she says things are a miracle, and she actually means it when she says it's a miracle, because she would say something about, you know, I got pregnant with my third child. It was a miracle. And I'm like, oh, ha. And she looks at me like very intently. She's like, no, it's a miracle at my age mm-hmm. to just randomly get pregnant. It obviously was God's plan.
Mm-hmm.
So she spoke a lot in very spiritual terms. And I had noticed that in interviews over the past few years. And, you know, we spoke about it a little bit. She said she knows it makes some people uncomfortable, particularly in rock music, you know, where it's not very cool to be religious. But she said religion has always sort of worked for her, and that's it's important to her.
This is also a person who she's extremely public. She's not shy. She's like out there and has an extremely sort of like shiny, approachable image and stuff. But she has had very few like serious relationships, or so she says, right?
Yes, I think it's true. I think she dated Tony Kanal, the bassist in No Doubt, from the time the band formed in 1987
yeah.
until 1995, because their breakup is what's captured on Tragic Kingdom. That's
yeah.
Don't Speak. And pretty much immediately, she started dating Gavin. I believe that she met him when she was either they were either on tour with Bush or on the same label, but they were associated. They were sort of like work acquaintances.
Yeah.
And she was with him until 2014, 2015.
Yeah. yeah.
And ran into Blake very shortly thereafter. She is in some ways delightfully and sort of cheerfully naive about love.
Well, this is the thing because, you know, I'm just talking about public perception here. I think of her as the pop star that I see in the supermarket line every week. But reading about her a lot recently, listening to this new record, realizing that this is the first one in 10 years, that you know, she made the record basically with the same songwriters all the way through, there's something about a sort of like integrity about
yeah.
her, a consistency about her. Like she's in for a pound that I'm not totally used to with pop stars of her level.
I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, we're used to seeing Madonna set the mold, right? You know, she by changing,
right.
by constantly evolving. And then you watch other people like Gaga constantly change. You know, Gaga's been 10 people since I
exactly.
became
change
acquainted
is,
with her.
That's her art form.
And then there are Miley, who's also change has become part of her DNA. You start as Hannah Montana. You end on stage with the Flaming Lips.
Yeah.
Not that she's done, but that's where she is right now.
Yeah.
You know, a Selena Gomez story where she was a Disney star and then she makes sort of like a more adult sexualized pop album.
Mm-hmm.
And Gwen has kind of been Gwen the whole time.
So how does she escape, you know, nostalgia and getting the horrible word irrelevant?
I think she does live in the moment and in the future and in her interests. You know, she doesn't dwell on the past a ton. I mean, she told me the story of this album, you know, reflecting on the past year and a half of her life. But she didn't want to go too far back. You know, when I sat down, I was like, let's talk about Madness, you know, and all the bands that inspired you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she would have been happy to have that conversation, but she knew we had a limited amount of time and she wanted to tell this story.
Did her eyes light up, though, when she...
She did. I told her I was on Spotify listening to Madness to prepare for the interview, and she was like, oh, man. And the photographer's assistant had I can't remember which band, but he had like a ska tattoo, and she was admiring his arm and talking about it. And she was like, people are still listening to ska. You know, you're looking around her house. I was only in the office of her house, you know, looking for clues to who she is now. And she had a very interesting library of books, lots of like fashion books, photography, Beatles, Kate Moss.
Mm-hmm.
And on the table, she has this giant marble table. She's got sunglasses and lipsticks and stuff. And then there's this container. And I'm like, I recognize that logo. It's Doc Martens. And it was Doc Martens Wonder Balsam, which, you know, is used for buffing up your docks.
Right.
So somewhere in that house, there are Doc Martens.
Oh, I would imagine.
And Gwen is keeping it real.
I would think there might be even a whole closet full of them.
Probably. She probably has them all for her kids, too. And everything is black and white. You know, like she's very two-tone.
Mm-hmm. So where would I be? Let's talk about that song.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant in general.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
So Where Would I Be is like the reggae banger.
I think it's the best song on the album.
You do?
I do, and I think Gwen thinks that too. Well, I don't just think, I know that, because we agreed together.
It's not a single, at least yet, right?
There
have been two singles?
Yeah, but it's upbeat. It has sort of like a very light reggae feel, and I believe she said it came towards the end of the album when she, you know, she had all the songs, she was gathering together, and, you know, what's missing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a part of her persona that... It's been a part of her artistic life since, you know, they started out as a ska band in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really fun song.
On Popcast, actually, I feel like we often circle around to the topic of like slick or cheap appropriations of reggae.
Mm.
I did not get that feeling when I listened to this song.
I agree.
It's cartoonish in the Gwen Stefani way of, you know, extremely bright colors and bouncy and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Somehow it didn't feel cheap.
It's like the bubble pop electric version of reggae.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe there's some like virtue in that, some sort of pop art virtue. You know what I mean?
I think she is good at distilling her true influences through the pop, you know, strainer.
Yeah.
I mean, No Doubt does have some cred. You know, they cut Rocksteady in Jamaica with like, you know, real reggae producers.
Yeah.
And I think it is in her blood.
Well, let's hear Where Would I Be from Gwen Stefani's new record, This Is What the Truth Feels Like. And thank you, Karen Gans, for coming and sharing your expertise.
Thanks, Ben. I'll be back soon.
And that's our show. Thank you for listening. You can hear Gwen Stefani's new tunes and other songs from her past associated with her on our Spotify playlist. You can also read Karen Gans's piece about Gwen Stefani at nytimes.com/music. You can listen to this episode and other episodes of New York Times Popcast on iTunes and Stitcher and Audio Boom. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.